The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
On the judging panel, I am in a sort of unique position because I actually won it. To be even on that list at all is a complete thrill.
The winner of the biggest prize for science writing will be announced this week. The Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books is fast approaching. And we hear from former winner and now chair of the judging panel, Richard Holmes. And...
I mean, it may be that consciousness is finally unanalyzed by consciousness, because we haven't anything like a coherent theory of consciousness.
The science writer and journalist Brian Appleyard fights for the supremacy of the human brain over the ever-encroaching power of the soulless machine. We discuss his book, The Brain is Wider Than the Sky. And we conclude our tour of the cosmos with the third part of the lecture Cosmological Connections by Professor Lawrence Krauss. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Here on Science Weekly, we're big fans of the skeptical mind, the probing of assumptions and the testing of scientific ideas. My next guest, therefore, should feel right at home. Brian Appleyard is the author of the new book, The Brain is Wider Than the Sky, Why Simple Solutions Don't Work in a Complex World. In the book, he challenges some of the common assumptions about our real understanding in scientific terms of who we are. In particular, he attacks what he calls the growing myth of our understanding of the brain. Neuroscience, he says, is a brilliant line of scientific inquiry, but it's been hijacked and simplified in the form of neural marketing and growing technological circumvention of the complexity of human neural functions. It's all quite heady stuff, so I dove right in and started by asking Brian to outline his biggest gripe about the current attempts to understand the brain.
I think in the last perhaps couple of decades, perhaps a little longer, there's a new point emerged at which both our knowledge and our capacity with machines, our engineering capacity, as it were, has started something new, which is a kind of invasion of the self. Now, again, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. Of course, we're curious about how we work. But it creates a new narrative, which is based upon the idea that we can, in fact... define ourselves. And the way it's coming in is first of all through neuroscience, which is actually a very primitive science, but it's very hyped at the moment. We're very early stages of this science, but it's very hyped, and I think vastly inflated claims are being made for it. It's not a science like physics, where you've got overarching theories. They don't have any overarching theories in neuroscience. They don't really know anything about the fundamental workings of the brain. They say this. People don't hear that bit. They hear the next bit where they hear, make it sound like a horoscope or something. The philosopher Jerry Fodor made a point about computational theories of the brain, which he championed once. But he said, the thing is, if we sort of believe in these computational theories, we'll throw quite a lot away in the process. We'll say, oh, that's true. Or this is the truth about the world, the truth about my mind. And we'll sort of leap ahead of ourselves.
So what are we missing out if we go into the simplistic views that sort of the early neuroscience is tempting us to go down?
By assuming that our innermost thought process is what these machines see, we don't know that is what they see. It might be an after effect of our thought process. It might be something else entirely. But if we assume that, then we're assuming that we have this direct knowledge of the human self. Now, we don't have direct knowledge of the human self, and I think it's unfreeing and it's reducing of imaginative life if we tend to see ourselves as simple emanations. So, for example, I mean, a lot of the book is about poetry, and the title is from an Emily Dickinson poem. Now, it's very easy to read Emily Dickinson from the point of view of neuroscience. I mean, she almost seems to be writing from the point of view of neuroscience at some times, but it's a complete mistake because, you know, the idea of saying there is a neuroscientific account of Emily Dickinson's poetry would make you think that that's all there was. And you wouldn't have any grasp of Emily Dickinson's poetry, which is some of the most, certainly the most magnificent American poetry ever written. You have to accept that Emily Dickinson, her poetry, is something that is never going to be accountable for in these terms. If you say it's accountable for in these terms, you get a whole load of new rhetoric, which I think is very damaging to a reducing of people's imaginations.
On the neuroscience front then, what are the areas that are interesting? What are the sort of things that you think we can get to? Because we rub up against various philosophical conundrums. One is the one you mentioned about taking away human complexity. You don't take that into account. But also, at some point, that human complexity comes from the brain. It comes from some emergent property of it all. So do you just give up trying to go there, or do you just have to work slightly harder?
Well, you certainly have to work harder. I'm not saying, you know, I think, you know, whatever we found out is fantastically interesting. I've had some amazingly interesting discussions with neuroscientists. There are tremendous stories in neuroscience, like the story I tell in the book of Henry Molaison, whose memory was destroyed, ability to form memories was destroyed by an operation. And this told us for the first time, how memories were captured by the brain. And these are fantastic stories, very interesting, very profound. But I think they make us, you know, if they make us race to premature conclusions, it's a waste. We're wasting this. One of the things about science, scientific claims, is they have an effect of giving people the impression, A, that they're final, which they never are, and B, they have this enormous authority. People talk frequently as if we were looking at ourselves with superhuman eyes through science, that we were looking at ourselves through the objective eye of science, which is some superhuman being, which is a metaphysical view, which is part of science. And that isn't true.
In that case, then, what the neuroscience and others are producing, how do we get back to filling that back in again and understanding this complexity?
Well, I think, towards the end of the book, I talk about what I take to be the best kind of science, which is a much more humble form of science, the one that doesn't rush to big claims. I mean, one of the examples I give is the discovery of organisms living beneath the seabed, which were thought impossible. It was impossible for anything to be living that deep under the seabed. But in fact, the total number of these things, the forms of extremophile, as they're called, total number of these things weighs more than all the rest of life on Earth put together. So that this is a gigantic realm. Now, this thrills me because it shows you how much more there is to know and how much we don't know. So really, the science I like is the science that admits our ignorance and is thrilled by that.
Now, admitting ignorance about the brain is probably quite fashionable amongst some neuroscientists these days, especially those who want lots of money to go and find out about it. But if I can pin you down on one thing, the brain is, as you say in the book, probably the most complex thing in the universe, or at least that we know of. Do you think that we can use our own brains to understand our brain, and will we ever achieve it?
This is a very interesting philosophical point. I mean, it may be that consciousness is finally unanalyzable by consciousness. It's like asking a film camera to take a picture of the film. It can't be done. It may be that that is the case. And certainly at the moment it is the case, because we haven't anything like a coherent theory of consciousness or a coherent idea of where consciousness comes from. In philosophy it's called the hard problem, how matter becomes mind. But it's so far completely unsolved, whatever claims are made.
And Brian's book, The Brain is Wider Than the Sky, Why Simple Solutions Don't Work in a Complex World, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson and is out now. As Brian Appleyard has clearly demonstrated, the book is still a key form in discussing some of the great scientific debates in public. With that in mind, every year the Royal Society gathers a panel of the great and the good to find the best science books of the past 12 months. To tell us about 2011's shortlist ahead of the prize announcement on November the 17th, we have the chair of the judges and former winner of the prize, science writer Richard Holmes.
So, my name is Richard Holmes. I'm on the jury of the Royal Society Winton Prize for science books this year. In fact, I'm the chair of the jury, or as I prefer to call myself, the deck chair of the jury. And we have a wonderful shortlist today.
Alex's Adventures in Numberland by Alex Bellos, published by Bloomsbury.
So alphabetically, the first book is by Alex Bellos. And actually, we love this book because it's about mathematics, and that in a way is the hardest nut to crack in science, and particularly for popular science writing. And I know there have been a number of books of this kind, but this is very, very special. It's very playful. It's got a wonderful range of materials. It travels round the globe. And one of the special things he does is he interviews different mathematicians. I mean, in Japan or in America or back here in England. And those interviews, often rather eccentric. There's one numerologist. From the moment Alex walks in the door, the numbers are flying out. This gives it a terrific life and play. But it takes, each chapter takes a theme. One of the ones that fascinated me, and this is the way he does it, he begins with pi, you know, that famous number that cannot ever be resolved. And the opening is, pi is the name of a man's aftershave by Givenchy, because it represents what is infinite and insoluble and magnificent. And from that, he goes into the whole theory of how people worked out pi, starting to about 50 places. Now supercomputers can do it too. I think it's over a million, probably, places. It still never comes out. And this leads him, by the end of the chapter, to talk about the notion, mathematical notions of infinity, Cantor, and areas where we're reaching the far end of the spectrum. That's the sort of classic way he does it. So it's playful, but it also takes you into very serious areas of mathematics. And I think for people who are terrified of mathematics, go for this book.
Through the Language Glass, How Words Colour Your World, by Guy Deutscher, published by William Heinemann.
Yes, now the Guy Deutscher book, a bit unusual this. It's a kind of combination of anthropology and language theory, and also perception theory and the notion of consciousness. The main opening theme is about how we all see colour and how do we describe colour. And he begins with this wonderful thing that so many people would know from school days, the Homer's description of the sea, the Homeric description, which is the wine dark sea. And he says, why is it wine dark? Has anybody ever seen the sea the colour of wine, whatever wine you're drinking? And he then, from that, he begins to look into the language which describes colour, and actually what is there a physiological reason whereby people might see colour slightly differently. So gradually, from that very simple 19th century idea, he opens right up into modern linguistics, perception theory, and so on. And he does the same in two other areas. One is the notion of tense and the future. What is the notions of future? How much is that defined by individual cultures and languages? And the other, very funny, is about gender and what particular cultures and languages do to gender. And of course, French and German are magnificently unpacked. And it's also very, very funny. What's unusual about this book, it's written in a kind of Mandarin style, which we all like very much, very clear. And the way he shows from language to actual physiological experiments, particularly linguistic problems analysed by physiological experiments, is very, very good. And you get the sense of the scientific process going on. So that's a reason why we love this book too.
The Disappearing Spoon by Sam Keane, published by Little Brown and Company.
The Disappearing Spoon. I will tell you why it's that title in a moment. This is a book about the periodic table, which most people remember again from school. It is that famous thing that looks like a castle wall that sets up all the different elements. For a long time, there were about 90 of them. Well, of course, originally there were about 20 in the period I love, the Romantic period. Then there were 90. Now it's certainly well over 100 because there's some artificial ones. So here's this sort of key concept in science, which is also, again, slightly threatening. How can you remember it? What's the link? What's the difference between atomic weight and atomic number? So you start off, you know, famous with the noble gases, hydrogen and so on, and then you go into the metals and so on. But he's done this in a very original way. Rather than work through in the classic scientific way through the numbers, he's taken certain human stories behind the people who either discovered the elements or used them. And he links them together as stories. For example, there's a chapter called Artistic Elements, and it's all to do with writers and painters and so on. I'll give you one example. There's a wonderful sequence which begins with the element of gold in the nib of the famous Parker 51 pen. All right, go. And then it goes through various other metals, passing by Mark Twain's typewriter. All right, that's pretty good. And then an element called, I think, radium, which becomes an image of what Satan wears because it inwardly glows but will ultimately destroy him. And it finishes up with a rather tragic section about the poet Robert Lowell taking lithium against depression. So that's just to give you very, very original sequences, all built around these nuggety biographical ideas. Again, playful, quite American in style. There's a certain amount of sort of what I call sort of fratty or prep humour about it. But it's written with a great lightness and touch. So we really enjoyed it. And I think we all came out thinking, we know a bit more about the periodic table, which is quite an achievement.
The Wave Watcher's Companion by Gavin Pretor-Pinney, published by Bloomsbury.
The Wave Watcher. This is a lovely book. It's, in a sense, it's deeply eccentric. What he's done, this is the chap who wrote his first book, I think was called The Cloud Watcher's Guide, or The Guide to Clouds, which was a great hit, was simply about looking at clouds and all the things, the way you could define them, what they did. Here he takes waves, which actually is a much more complicated subject, and he starts simply, I think, with his little daughter on the beach looking, you know, the famous count, is the seventh wave bigger, etc. And from that he begins to analyse what a wave actually is, which is not necessarily what you think. It's a form of energy travelling through water and so on. And then he takes this idea of waves and he looks at the world all around us. So it would include, say, quite human things like the Mexican wave, all right? And then fairly simple natural things like the movement of a snake, say, or the seven bore, that the wave of water that comes down the Severn estuary in the West Country. And then he moves towards much more subtle things, towards electromagnetic waves and how those work. Very, very good descriptions of those. He uses eccentric little pictures and diagrams to explain this. And the marvel, I think, of this book, and it's quite, of all the books, it's a very poetic book in a curious way. It really made us all look at the world around us differently. And that was for all of us. There was one of our judges said, I was waiting for a bus and I started watching the water streaming down in the gutter and the way it was making little eddies and waves. And suddenly then I looked at the bus queue and I realised that was moving in a wave and so on. So it's a kind of visionary book, eccentric, visionary, and written with great passion. We loved it.
Massive, the missing particle that sparked the greatest hunt in science by Ian Sample, published by Basic Books.
Massive. Oh, yes. This is a fine book. I think, in fact, Ian Sample is a Guardian journalist, so I had to be very careful what I say at this moment, but I don't think he's just outside the door. This is, of course, about the search for the famous Higgs boson particle, which I'll explain in a moment. So broadly, it's about particle physics. And it's told in the form of almost a thriller story. It's the biography of Peter Higgs and how he goes to America and he gives this paper about fields in particle physics. And these catch on, and the standard model, which is, most of us know the model of the atom with the nucleus and the protons and the electrons going around. But of course, what's called a standard model, it's now broken down into much, invisible is almost the wrong word for it. I think there's 17 basic particles. But to energize these, you need an energy particle. And this is the Higgs boson, the boson of the energy. And this is the one that no one has found. So the book starts with the life of young Peter Higgs, and then gradually how numerous scientists begin to contribute towards this. And in a way, the idea of the Higgs boson outruns its author. And then, of course, we go to the Hadron Collider and the American equivalent and the amazing money that's used to do this. And then the notion that it's the God particle. I noticed the paperback uses that, hunting for the God particle. They've changed it. So it's a thriller book, but which does really succeed to a great degree in describing what we know as particle physics. Although I think, who was it to say? I think Richard Feynman said, if you think you understand it, you don't understand it, okay? But it carries quite a lot of theoretical baggage in a very good thriller story, to which, of course, there's no end yet because the Higgs boson has not been found. So we were rather thrilled by this book.
The Rough Guide to the Future by John Turney, published by Rough Guides.
Yes, one of the Rough Guides. The Rough Guides have been shortlisted before, and you probably know their format. They're quite different from the other five books. They're short, little chunky, nuggety sections. And it is exactly what it says. It's the notion of the future, particularly seen through technology and technological possibilities, and also projections like projecting population growth, climate change, obviously, alternative energies, that kind of thing. And each in little nuggety sections. But one of the unusual things, it also includes how the notion of the future has changed. So it goes back into quite literary sections. H.G. Wells is there, for example. But a lot of 19th century thinking about the future is included in the sections. So it's very unusual from that. It looks at the past of the future as well as the future of the future. We also like the format, which are these short, chunky sections, which give you little bibliographies, reading lists, and they're kind of inspiring quotes, mostly from scientists all around the world, and they're very, very well chosen. So it's a wonderful book. We all travelled with this book. You could open it up in a train or a bus and read it, and you'd have food for thought. Very provocative, very unusual book. So, we were enthusiastic about this.
Well, yes, on the judging panel, I am in a sort of unique position because two years ago, I actually won the prize with a book called The Age of Wonder, which is about the history of science, really, in the Romantic period. So I know about this prize. And, of course, when I was shortlisted for it, I read it up. It was formed in 1988, I think. And it really, you know, to be even on that list at all is a complete thrill. And this year, for example, I think we had 135 books. So that anybody who's got to the... we did publish a long list, and now the short list. You know, that is really something. And because of the Royal Society, you know, which is known around the world, I found when I went to America with my book, they all knew about it through that. And indeed, I was sort of gave a talk to the American Academy of Sciences, because of that. So it's a very thrilling thing to be on the short list.
Thanks to Richard Holmes there. The winner of this year's accolade of the Science Book of the Year will be announced on November the 17th at the Royal Society. And if you're in London and close to the Society in Mayfair, near St James's Park, you can go along to the announcement. Doors open at 5:45pm for a 6:30pm start, and seats will be allocated on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information, go to the website royalsociety.org. Oh, and of course, may the best Ian Sample win. Look, impartiality does have its limits. We continue with the final part of the Cosmic Connections lecture, in which Professor Lawrence Krauss takes us on a tour of the universe. In this, the final part, Lawrence finishes up his lecture with a defence of his trade and takes up some insightful questions from the audience.
I thought of this one day when I was stuck in traffic in Los Angeles. Another connection that I think is remarkable, because I do theoretical physics and it's kind of esoteric and people say, why the hell do you do it? What's it good for? Which amazes me when they say that, because, you know, I rarely get asked, what's a Picasso painting good for? Or what's a Mozart concerto good for? But somehow science has to do something and somehow make a better toaster or something like that. But the biggest and most important thing about science is not that it does anything, but that it enhances our lives with beautiful ideas that change the way we think about ourselves. That's what I wanted to do here this morning. Because that's what all good art, literature, and music is all about. It's changing our perspective of our place in the universe. And that's what science does. And hopefully some of the examples I've given to you will change the way you think about yourself when you go home after this lecture. But from the sublime and profound of the atoms that make us up, I wanted to go to the profane and ridiculous of traffic. So, the esoteric stuff I do, some people say it never impacts on me. You know, what's general relativity got to do with me? The answer is that it's everything. So here's the route we took from my hotel to get here, thanks to Google and Google Maps and the fact that I have an iPhone that allows me to see where I am because it has GPS. Our lives have changed because of GPS. When you want to go to one place or another in London, use GPS not just to find the way, but sometimes even to find where the traffic isn't, because many GPS devices will tell you that. And what are GPS devices? Well, they're satellites above the Earth, and there are a whole network of them located about, this is true to scale, that's about the size of the Earth and its atmosphere, and these things are located about 8,000 miles up above the Earth, and there's a whole network of them, so that there's enough of them that they can see a few of them are visible, usually on average at least four, from any place on Earth. And this allows us to tell where we are in the following way. We use triangulation. So if we want to see where we are here, what we do is we look at two satellites and we measure the time it takes for the light to get from that satellite to here and bounce back. And we just measure the time. Now, light travels about 30 centimeters every nanosecond. A nanosecond is a billionth of a second. So if we want to tell, all we have to do then is to tell the travel difference between these two things. And if we can measure things to a nanosecond, we can measure the accuracy of where we are to 30 centimeters. Now the clock, so we need atomic clocks on these objects. Now these objects on orbit, as I say, 12,000 miles, it turns out, 8,000 miles per hour. I was converting from kilometers for British units. And therefore, if we want to do what GPS devices do, which is have an accuracy of 5 to 10 meters, we have to have a timing accuracy of 20 to 30 nanoseconds, which atomic clocks can have. And then you can measure the time it takes one light ray to come, or a radar signal to come to you, and the other. And if you can tell the clocks and measure the time differences of 20 billionths of a second, then you can tell where you are on the Earth to 5 meters. And that's how these things work. Okay? But they wouldn't work, it turns out, if that was the whole story, because relativity matters. It turns out, for example, these things are moving, I said, at 8,000 miles per hour. Einstein told us that if you were moving relative to me, your clocks are ticking slower than mine. At 8,000 miles per hour, they tick a little bit slower. And normally, that's irrelevant. But when I have to measure time to nanoseconds, it matters. And in fact, if I work it out, those clocks are ticking more slowly than clocks on Earth by 10 microseconds a day. 10 microseconds a day, they're clicking more slowly. But that's not the whole story, because general relativity tells us that space is curved around the Earth, and that something even stranger happens, that if I take a clock and I put it in a place that's not quite as curved as it is at the surface of the Earth, the clock will tick faster than it does on the surface of the Earth. A clock in the balcony here is clicking at a different rate than the clocks here, because you're at a different point in a gravitational field. And if I work that out, it turns out those clocks are ticking faster than clocks on Earth due to general relativity by 45 microseconds per day. Now let's work that out. That means the time difference between each clock here and a clock on Earth is 38 microseconds, because they're clicking slower due to special relativity and faster due to general relativity, by 38 microseconds a day. But 38 microseconds is 38,000 nanoseconds. And that means if the makers of GPSs did not take into account general relativity and special relativity on a given day, after 2 minutes, your GPS device would be off by more than 10 meters, and after a day, it would give you an answer that was 10 kilometers wrong. You can find yourself on your way through London precisely because we need to take into account the fact that space around the Earth is curved every single day. It's not just esoteric nonsense. Your life depends upon it, because, of course, your life depends upon getting here on time to hear me. So, that's all of the cosmic connections I wanted to talk about, the good, the bad. And to me, when I think about these connections, I think about the worst that makes up humanity, and the best that makes up humanity, the science. To me, those ideas are what makes it worth being human. And the ideas of science are among the most beautiful and seductive ideas that humans have ever created. And it is a shame that we hide those ideas from people, or somehow people think they're boring or irrelevant, and they're not. Your very connection to the universe depends upon them. So I'll skip Virgil, but I'll just leave you with this image of the sun as seen from by an eclipse of the earth of the sun as seen from the surface of the moon. And to say that in spite of the fact that you are totally insignificant and that the future is miserable, we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. Thank you very much. Do we have time? Thank you. I don't know what the schedule is. Do we have time for some questions now? Anyone have any questions? Good, there are questions. Well, I don't know. I'm going to pick this man first, which means you have to run.
Thanks for that. Fantastic, by the way. If water's not made on the Earth, is there somewhere it just forms? Where do we think it forms?
Well, actually, I mean, water and carbon dioxide are produced after the supernova explosions happen. Those chemical reactions occur and molecules form out in space. And so you get iron granules and water and carbon dioxide, which freeze and adhere to those iron granules. And those things build up. And so there's huge amounts of water, small particles and larger particles. And in fact, what happens when a star condenses, the hydrogen gas condenses, but this disk around it, full of rock and water and ice, forms, called an accretion disk. And what happens is that those particles start to collide and sometimes stick together, forming bigger particles. And finally, the particles get big enough so that their gravity attracts other particles, and that's when planets begin to form. And so the first planet that forms starts to gobble up things before anything else, and Jupiter did. That's why Jupiter is 1,000 times the mass of the Earth. It gobbled up things first. But what Jupiter did also, gravity does strange things. And when Jupiter formed, its gravity kicked out a lot of these other dust particles with water to the outer part of the solar system, to what's called the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. And the Oort Cloud and Kuiper Belt are these two regions which are full of comets and asteroids, full of rocky particles, if they're a case of asteroids, or just simply frozen water and carbon dioxide in the outer part of our solar system. And what happens is that gravitational perturbations every now and then kick one in out of its orbit, and it heads towards the Earth or towards the Sun. Some of them we see as comets. The nearby ones, like Halley's Comet, come from within the orbit of between Mars and Jupiter. And other ones that are long-lived come from the outer solar system, and sometimes they collide on Earth. So there's a huge reservoir of water existing in a big spherical cloud out around our solar system. We think that Oort cloud extends out to halfway to the next star. And I believe the number is roughly 100 tons a day of material is impacting upon the Earth, much of it containing water. Okay, we'll do it in the front here. Where's my... Oh, here's the devil. Okay. We'll take this young lady here first.
I was wondering what you had to say about, you know, we've heard about these massive cosmic influences on the formation of the Earth and the future of the Earth, but what effect does human behavior have? You know, so in terms of global warming and things like that, do we have an effect or in the face of these huge...
Well, the interesting thing is we have an effect and we don't. It's a wonderful question. We have an effect on our own lives and the climate that we experience. There's no doubt that humans, there's zero doubt that humans are affecting climate, that global climate change is happening. It's not some theoretical model, it's happening. The oceans are raising, all of it, we can measure it. Okay? The oceans are getting more acidic. Humans are changing the climate in ways that no animal has ever changed the climate on Earth before. We've produced an Earth that has never existed, and the abundance of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere has never been approached in the last 500,000 years. Even though there are natural variations, it's nowhere near what we have now. So we are changing the climate of the Earth. How it's going to change is not so obvious, and whether it'll cause catastrophic problems, at least is not so obvious, but it could. And in fact, the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has been very conservative because it talks about changing ocean levels changing by centimeters over the next century. If you look at the record of ice cores in Antarctica and also in the Dead Sea, you will find that over the course of 500,000 years, the Earth's ocean levels have changed by more than 80 meters. And we are at a level of carbon dioxide that's never been, that's totally unprecedented. So it's quite possible, and this can happen over the period, not just of thousands of years, but centuries or decades, because it's a very nonlinear process. So we don't really know what's going to happen, but there's a possibility the ocean levels could change, not just by centimeters, but by meters or tens of meters. But even if it's centimeters or meters, we're going to displace perhaps 2 to 4 billion people on Earth from their current living surroundings, and that is going to change human history. And we are fools not to realize that we need to think about that. So that's the myopic version of the answer. But the non-myopic version of the answer is it doesn't really matter. Because for our atoms, their future is largely the same. We have two choices. We either use our brains as a civilization and moderate our behavior to accommodate not just climate change, but the changing involvement. The sun's going to evolve, and in 2 billion years, the Earth will be 1,000 degrees. It won't be pleasant. And so we can use our brains and maybe escape the Earth. Yeah. That's right. It's all your fault. And it maybe escape the Earth and bring our atmosphere with us, so us and our oxygen atoms will go out in the cosmos, or we blow it, which is equally likely, it seems to me, and then we die off. The sun, in 4.5 billion years, will use up its hydrogen fuel. It will increase in size till it encompasses the Earth orbit. It will blow off the atmosphere of the Earth. And either way, our oxygen atoms are going to end up in the cosmos, and they're not going to give a damn whether they came with us or not. Their future will be essentially the same whether we lived or not. And all evidence of our existence will be gone. And we have the choice of whether we take any evidence of our existence out into the cosmos with it, or whether we disappear as likely as many of those civilizations on that first slide I showed may have disappeared, and so that the universe doesn't really care about them, and the universe doesn't really care about us. That's a fun... I'd love to end on that, but I won't. Okay, let's go with this young man.
Hey, yeah, I was just wondering, what's your favorite theory for how the universe is going to end?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think it's going to end with a whimper and not a bang. I'm not sure it's my favorite theory, but it is, because I don't have favorites. I force myself to actually conform to the evidence of reality. Although I did first propose this, and I think it's right in this case, one of those rare cases. It turns out that one of the most amazing things we have discovered, and indeed this year's Nobel Prize went for it, is that the expansion of the universe isn't slowing down. It's speeding up. It's speeding up because we think the dominant stuff in the universe is nothing, the energy of empty space. It's so important that I've written a book about it, which is coming out in January. But this empty space, energy in empty space, is causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate, and that means that distant galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster and faster, not slower and slower and slower as we thought they should do. But that means eventually they'll be moving away from us faster than the speed of light. And when they do that, we won't be able to see them anymore. And you can work out, because by the way, you're allowed to do that in general relativity. In special relativity, you've got to be like a lawyer and parse it more carefully. You cannot travel through space faster than the speed of light, even if you're a neutrino, by the way. But space can do whatever the hell it wants. And so space can carry distant stars and galaxies away from us faster than the speed of light. When they do that, the light never makes it to us. And if you work it out in merely 10 trillion years, which may not seem like a long time except compared to this lecture, the rest of the universe will have disappeared. The universe will consist of a single galaxy as far as observers who live around stars in our galaxy are concerned. They'll build telescopes, they'll discover general relativity, they'll discover electromagnetism, and they'll look out and see nothing. And they'll think they live in the universe that we thought we lived in 100 years ago, with a single galaxy and empty space. They'll have no evidence that there was a Big Bang, no evidence that the universe is expanding. All of that knowledge will have disappeared. And so those people will live in a cold, dark, empty universe, which will eventually, the stars will die out, and the universe will become colder and darker and empty. So that's the future, okay? Now, I'm an optimist, as you can tell, and so I've always said that for those people in the far future who may evolve on a different planet, they'll be lonely and ignorant, but they'll be dominant. And those of us who live in the United States are quite used to that. Maybe that's a good way to end this. Thank you very much.
Cosmological Connections was a lecture hosted at the School of Life. For more information, go to theschooloflife.com. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. On that website, by the way, you'll also find a new series of short films we're making in association with the British Heart Foundation. These films, well, tutorials really, will be running throughout November and will bring you insights on everything from how a single heartbeat works to the drugs that have helped us live longer and the future techniques that will help to repair damage and disease. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS. Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243, PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.